So this evening we're continuing with a series that we've begun on an examination of what in this tradition are called the hindrances or obstacles to concentration. Of course, I've never experienced any of those, so I'm speaking from theory alone here. Nor, I'm sure, of any of you. So, what to say? Well, maybe a good place to begin is where we left off last time. And in order to do that, perhaps to refresh our memory a little bit about some matters of nomenclature, you know, the Pali terms for some of these states of consciousness and practices that we're investigating. So, you know, the Buddha's Eightfold Path is divided into three sections: effort, mindfulness, concentration, the samadhi factors, the meditative factors. Okay. Right understanding, right intention, the wisdom factors, and then skillful speech, action, and way of life, the fruition. You know, if you go to a temple anywhere in Asia, or the Wat here in Denver for that matter, and you look at the altar, you'll see these three objects. You'll find candles, and you'll find incense, and you'll find flowers. The incense represents samadhi, the meditation factors, bringing the mind into focus and calming it so you can see clearly. The candles are the light of wisdom. And the flowers represent fruition, bringing into being the fruits of the meditative qualities and the wisdom. So in these meditative factors, the three of them collectively are sometimes referred to as samadhi. That's one of the uses of that word samadhi. Okay. Samadhi is also used in a narrower sense, translated usually as concentration. Not a great translation, actually, Pali scholars tell me. Bhikkhu Bodhi, the scholar who's teachings and writings I tend to follow pretty closely as far as an understanding of the Pali Canon is concerned, says tranquil, focused, sustained attention. Okay. Tranquil, focused, sustained attention. The ability to bring the mind to bear on a particular object of meditation and to investigate it with great care as it begins to reveal its secrets. And then one aspect of this use of samadhi or concentration, remember, tranquil, focused, sustained attention. One aspect of that tranquility, Pali word for that is shamatha. And that's also, to keep things from getting too clear, that's also sometimes used interchangeably with concentration. So a lot of times in all the Dharma practices, you know, especially the Theravada practices and the Tibetan practices, you'll hear talk about shamatha and vipassana. Okay. So shamatha, the ability to calm and focus the mind and bring it to bear on the object of meditation. Okay. And vipassana, mindfulness of all that's going on. So one way to think about those two qualities of mind that are cultivated when you're meditating, the shamatha practices, they're kind of like an electron microscope. You're seeking to train the mind to see with more and more and greater precision the minutiae of the construct of consciousness, what's going on in the mind, how we bring the self into being, and how we might, from time to time, abstain from doing so. By contrast, vipassana, or mindfulness, is like a Hubble telescope. Okay. It's capable of holding everything in a vast field, and watching the arising and passing of all phenomena, So when we were beginning to sit together, actually we were having little tastes of both. You know, mindfulness of the breathing is a shamatha practice, bringing the mind to bear just on that simple bodily sensation of the air moving in and out of the nostril or the abdomen rising and falling. Okay. And then a little later on in the practice, I was suggesting to open the field of awareness, to take into account not only the breathing, but bodily sensations and sounds and thoughts and emotions. That's opening from one to the other. Okay. And then for the rest of our time together, you know, we're doing a rising and passing. Okay. Shikantaza, I think that it's called in the Zen tradition. Okay. So these are two complementary forms of meditation practice within this greater realm of the meditative factors. And they have the effect of, when they're being practiced skillfully, of really strengthening and supporting and enriching each other, okay? And helping each other to become more profound and powerful and precise and refined. So when we begin to meditate, one thing that oftentimes happens when we begin to encounter some difficulty, okay, is that, you know, the popular advertising around meditation practices right now, and now it's quite the end thing to do, right? And you meditate in order to release and reduce stress and calm yourself down and have a clear mind and all these things, that these mind capabilities that you're supposed to be able to acquire without having to go down to the Frosted Leaf and buy something, you know, OTC to do the same thing, right? And so you sit down and you start doing the practice, and it's like, okay, where's the tranquility? Where's the clarity? Where's the calmness? I must not be doing it right. Either that, or I've been hosed. They promise one thing, but that's sure as hell not what's going on. So there's this inevitable tendency to feel like you don't have the hang of it, or you're not doing it right, or maybe you chose the wrong practice or something, whenever the difficulties begin to arise. However, insofar as really being able to learn what's going on in mind, that's not such a useful point of view. It seems to be an inevitable one. It happens for all of us. There's this tendency to feel like somehow or another we don't have the hang of it, or we're not very skilled, if in fact, instead of tranquil, peaceful, loving feelings, we're instead feeling some anger and ill will, or we're overwhelmed by lust, or we can't stay awake, or we feel really antsy and restless and can barely sit still, or we become suspicious that maybe this entire realm of practice and inquiry is a big mistake. So, in my experience, the more skillful and useful and constructive way to understand what happens when these mind states arise, okay, especially when we think about shamatha and vipassana in partnership with each other, right? The way that it's possible to use mindfulness to help the mind become more clear and steady, to really develop the capacity for concentration, for tranquil, focused, sustained attention, when that's not what's happening, is to use mindfulness practice as a tool for inquiry into why the mind cannot be calm. So what you do in this other way, which is basically taking what, you know, and the names don't help much either. Hindrances, obstacles to concentration, you know, it's like a locked door that you can't get through or whatever, okay. What the kind of metamorphosis, the transmutation that can occur, the morphing of what seems like a brick wall or an obstacle into a really important teaching happens when we're able to use mindfulness to inquire skillfully into why the mind is having difficulty concentrating. So if these five hindrances, for instance, with anger, if you're finding that there's a lot of anger arising, okay, when you're sitting, okay, there are ways to deconstruct the experience of anger, to inquire more deeply into it, right? What is the nature of this anger? Anger is a short word, but it covers a lot. Okay. So there's two ways to go about it. One is to become more precise about the object of the anger. Okay. And the other is to become more precise about what the true nature of the anger is. So for instance, if you're feeling angry at a person, okay, is it a difficulty, an interpersonal difficulty you're having with somebody you're in a relationship with or somebody you don't know very well? Maybe you feel ill will towards certain political leaders or certain aspects of the economic system. It could be kind of institutional, right? So being as careful as you can with regard to what's the object of the anger? What are you feeling ill will towards? And the other is, what's the precise nature of the aversive feeling? Okay. Is it kind of irritation? Okay. Is it rage? Is it resentment? Okay. Is it malicious intent? There are all kinds of ways to begin to unpack what the nature of the anger is. In this process of alchemizing the hindrances and turning them into teachers. Okay. The other thing that I found really helpful over the years is to look at these teachings on the hindrances in relationship to the broader teachings in the Theravada psychology tradition, you know, that the Buddha taught about what the real roots of these things are. Okay. And the real roots of them are three. And they're called, again, you know, they have these terrible, unuseful names, I think, you know, the three poisons, torments of the mind, you know, hell realms, of aversion and attachment and delusion. People like Rick Hansen and the other folks that are into meditation and neuroscience and whatnot say, basically, the reason we're here is a species, and the really reason any successful species is here is because the body is hardwired to do three things. The first is to seek out that which it needs to survive. The other is to ward off or get away from potential threats. And the other is to block out everything else, because of the kind of the millions of sensory inputs, you know, that you block out everything basically in your environment, the way you perceive the environment, that doesn't have to do either with satisfying a need, you know, exploiting an opportunity, or avoiding threats, avoiding possible harm. So up to a point, very useful skills to have, hardwired into our being, you know, into our consciousness at a very, very deep primitive level. One way of understanding what's going on, though, with regard to suffering in the world and what the Buddha had to teach about it, is that these three capabilities of mind kind of got out of hand. Okay. And the warding off threat, okay, heightened into powerful states of aggression. Okay. Fear and hatred and anger and willingness to do harm to another, okay? That seeking out opportunities kind of morphed into exploitative greed, ceaseless, unending greed, always wanting more, always wanting more. Okay. As in economic models that basically say grow or die, the idea of a steady state economy is somehow anathema, right? At any rate, no, we don't have to go there. And then the third, you know, that of delusion, just of not paying attention to anything that you don't find pleasing and that you don't find threatening. So these are kind of undercurrents that are an element of the human personality. Seeking out pleasure, avoiding pain, and blocking out everything else. Okay, so those are aspects of our consciousness. It's just the hand we got dealt. When they kind of get out of hand and they go to their extremes, they have these different ways of causing suffering. So what the Buddha taught was basically waking up to these tendencies in the mind. And then when you see them arising, not acting on the unskillful urges that come up, okay, but only acting on the ones that seem, you know, within bounds, that seem useful. Those three aspects of mind, you know, attachment, aversion, and delusion. They're kind of like a three-piece jazz combo, right? And in Buddhist psychology, the understanding is they're all active. They all have the potential to kind of wreak havoc and cause up a lot of problems for yourself and others. Okay? But one of them will probably tend to mostly play the lead. Okay, and that's where this notion of different personality types in Theravada Buddhism comes from. That while all three of those are at work, you might find yourself experiencing more than any, you know, on average, over time, you might find yourself in an aversive state of mind. Or you might find yourself mostly in kind of a greedy state of mind, you know, a hungering state of mind. Okay. Or you might find yourself just wanting to have as little to do with the world as possible and simply not being interested or wanting to deeply inquire into what's going on, you know, a deluded kind of personality, clueless. Those three underlying tendencies have a strong working relationship with the hindrances. Okay. So like in the Wasatch Mountains in southeastern Utah, there's this 107-acre forest that on the surface looks like it's about 67,000 different aspen trees. But the dendrologists have checked this thing out and they find that they're all genetically identical. It's the world's largest and oldest living thing. It's been around for 80,000 years. They all share one root mass. Okay. So on the surface, it looks like they're individual trees. Underneath, not so much. Okay. So one way of understanding this relationship is that these qualities of mind, these tendencies toward, you know, attachment, aversion, and delusion are fairly universal. And they manifest, okay, as individual feelings of anger, or individual feelings of greed, or lust, or individual feelings of disinterest and disengagement. It's also a pretty good metaphor I found for the illusion of separate beings. You know, I go to that one a lot, this idea that we look around the room and we all look like separate trees, but underneath it all, you know, there are these connections that we barely have the ability to ascertain. So at any rate, getting back to the hindrances once again, you can see that the anger, when it arises, is coming from this deeper place. And the deeper place is one that perceives threat. Okay. So whenever you feel anger toward anything, or resentment, or rage, or whatnot, the underlying reason is because there's the object of your anger you see as a threat to yourself, or to society, or to our environment, or in some way or another, this thing that you're angry about is in some way, in your view, threatening your well-being. And it may be a very distinct and palpable threat, you know, somebody threatening physical violence or you know, some drunk weaving in and out in traffic or something like that, where it's quite obvious that there's something, you know, really bad going on. The mind state of aversion actually manifests as two different of the hindrances. One is of anger, and the other is the realm of restlessness and worry. You remember, again, the five hindrances, you know, anger, lust, sloth and torpor, and restlessness and worry, and the fifth one is doubt. Okay. So the mind state of anger and the mind state of restlessness and worry are basically two sides of the same coin, fight or flight, essentially. Okay. So when you feel momentary anger arise when you're sitting, okay, it's again because there's something going on in your mind in terms of how you see the world or how you're interacting with others that seems troubling to you and that seems like it is posing some kind of threat. When there's restlessness and worry at work, okay, it's the same thing. Something's not right. Something, you know, if only I adjust my posture, then I'll be able to have a good set. Or something, if only, if only, if only. Okay. But there's something that's not right about the present moment that will be right if you somehow or another change things, and so you change them and that doesn't work, and then you change again and that doesn't work. But the mind is incapable of being at rest. Okay. So it is likewise in this kind of skittish state, and it may feel like it's just kind of momentary or minor or elusive things that are making you feel unrest. Inquired into at a deeper level, we can find that there are much deeper roots to the state of restlessness or the state of worry or the state of what we experience as absence of peace of mind. And the Pali word for that is samvega. And there's this teaching, we another time we can delve more deeply into this, the sort of the eight worries or the eight anxieties that are, again, a classic part of Buddha Dharma, you know, of fears of the future consequences of past unskillful action. You know, what goes around comes around. Fear of loss of nutriment, of not being able to find enough to eat, and not being able to find what you need to survive. Fear of death. Okay, these are all things that kind of hide out in the shadows most of the time because we don't particularly want to acknowledge them. That's the function of sloth and torpor, which prevents you from thinking about things that you don't want to think about, so you don't look at the world at all, period. You get past sloth and torpor and all of a sudden, there's all the things they didn't want to think about, and the mind becomes restless and worried. So the restlessness and the anger both have their roots in the aversive state of mind, okay, of threat to self in some form or other. Capiche? Maybe we should take a moment, reflect on those thoughts for a minute. You have any experience that comes to mind that resonates at all with what I've said? Yeah, please.
Another way I've heard restlessness, you know, that the other aspect of that particular hindrance is remorse.
Oh, say more, please.
Well, it's restlessness and remorse is you know, sitting there remembering the unskillful actions and ruining them, regretting them.
So, yes. You know. Yes, exactly, right. Jack Kornfield, I've heard him say on occasion that one of the purposes or one of the functions of this practice is to give up all hope of ever having had a better past. It is what it is. It was what it was, right? And so what Don's describing is one of those eight anxieties, you know, it's an aspect of Samvega, you know, of saying, oh, wow, should I ever blow it, you know? I'm really sorry, you know? And in 12-step programs, in fact, one of the really important steps is recognizing ways you blew it, but instead of, you know, just sitting there stewing and thinking about what a jerk I am, it's making amends, right? It's going and saying, I acknowledge my unskillful action. My unskillful words, you know. And whether the other person is capable of hearing that acknowledgement and forgiving, you know, is up to them. But it's a gesture of healing, right? Yeah.
You know, I actually think of remorse as a really useful, mm-hmm. a useful aspect of the hindrances. In other words, I don't see it as a hindrance exactly. I know, you know, especially on extended retreats, I've had, going in and talking to my teachers about it and having them say, ah, yes, the whole life review. Mm-hmm. In other words, you know, that it's an essential part of the whole process mm-hmm. to bring all that stuff up and to understand what it was that
yeah.
did that was unskillful.
Yes, thank you. One of the distinctions in the language that you hear a fair amount in this particular tradition is the distinction between guilt and remorse.
Yeah.
Guilt being feeling really badly about something you did in the past that harmed yourself and another, that caused pain to another. And when that recollection, when that memory comes up, engaging in deep self-condemnation as a result. Feeling shame and feeling guilt for having done what you did. And it's like a wound that won't heal. You feel that you're always going to have to carry around these heavy feelings, that you're going to sentence yourself for the rest of your life to live in this dark little cell that you've created in your mind, okay, as a way of doing penance for the wrong you did in the past.
So that's guilt.
Guilt and shame, yes. Okay. Mm.
As opposed to remorse. Right?
As opposed to remorse. And the distinction is this. Guilt and shame are predicated on a self feeling guilt and shame. On there being a me that's guilty. A me who feels ashamed. Okay. The distinction, at least in this way of languaging, is that with regard to remorse, there's not so much of an I there. What there is a present state of consciousness that can look back with compassion on who you were at the time that you did that unskillful thing. So when you're thinking about this from the standpoint of there being a permanent and abiding self, I'm the one that did that back then. I'm the one that said this back then. And I am the same now as I was then, and I was terrible, and I'm, you know, I can never trust myself again because that's who I am. Okay. That's the permanent and abiding self model that in this particular tradition, not so useful. Instead, in this tradition, the understanding is that the mind is constantly birthing and dying the self on a continuous basis. Okay. So it's like there's this time machine device in my operating system, and every hour, every 6 hours or whatever, it kind of takes a picture of everything that's on the hard drive and saves it for a while, right? And so if you lost some document or something, then you can sometimes go back in time to an earlier frame, when it saved things at a certain point in time. Okay. It's a little like that. So we have these cells that we create. Okay, and each one is kind of like the one before, but not really. And how it's different depends on the intentions that went into creating the self in the moment. So in this looking, in this vantage point of remorse, what you're able to do, it's like standing to one side and saying, oh, look who I was in that point in time and what I did then and with what consequences. And if you can do that, clearly, that's why Kuan Yin's up here, because it, and the necessary ingredient in looking back on the painful past is being able to look back with compassion. You know, it's one of the things that's really, it's a really important teaching, for instance, for military combat veterans, where things, kind of unskillful things, happen in the field sometimes, right? And so you either carry that corrosive memory with you to your grave, right? Or at some point in time you're able to say, oh, look who I was then, look what the circumstances were. Look what I did as a result. And you can feel some, then some compassion for who that person was then. It's not kind of trying to absolve yourself of responsibility. It's seeing it in a very different context. Yes, please.
So the difference is being able to let go of that self-concept. We're seeing it, I was unskillful, but I can let go of the fact that I screwed up, okay, but I can let it go.
Yes, I did that. I can clearly see that I did that because I was in a state of rage, or I was in a state of terror, or I was in one of these other really unskillful mind states, or I was choosing to be utterly deluded about what the effects of my speech or actions were. Okay, so you can see the suffering state of mind you were in at the time that you did the unskillful thing.
So if I'm a mass murderer, though, I go, I screwed up. Doesn't that, I've kind of seen that, at least in my experience, that Buddhist thought and experience can lead to a certain amount of arrogance in letting ourselves off the hook when maybe we shouldn't.
Ha. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, what actually you're describing is a fairly deluded state of mind. One of the people who came to the Buddha was in fact a mass murderer. He was a bandit, you know. He led this group of, you know, real nasty people, you know, and they went around the countryside raping and pillaging and stealing and murdering lots of folks, and he did horrible things, and he was the scourge of the countryside, and they all wanted him dead. And at some point he just realized what a mess he'd made of things, and he went to the Buddha and said, I would be your student. And the Buddha took him in, and he took robes, and he would go with him on alms rounds, and everywhere they would go, people would stone this guy. And they'd yell at him, and they'd throw offal on him, and he was beaten to within an inch of his life. And he just continued to follow the Buddha and witness his transformation. And at some point, it is said, he gained enlightenment. And it was because he was every moment of every day acknowledging the present day consequences of his past behavior. So there was no aspect of his consciousness that was about, oh, well, that was who I was then, darn. Yes, I kind of screwed up. It was taking continuing responsibility for the fruition of his past actions. But again, it's different than the guilting and shaming that we tend to do to ourselves instead, because again, it's this sort of notion of penance that we kind of deserve it. Since we did harm to others, now is to kind of balance things out, we need to harm ourselves. And insofar as, you know, the Buddha, I teach one thing and one thing only, suffering and the end of suffering. How is it a compassionate or skillful thing to do? to go through your life considering yourself to be less than others. Okay. And in Buddha, there is a student of the Buddha, Queen Malika, and they were talking once about the nature of and necessity of, in this practice, the absolute necessity, I'm sorry, tough work, but you gotta do it, of self-love. And it's the way the story came up, there is Queen Malika was a commoner who was looked upon favorably by the master of, you know, the king and her, where she lived, and he elevated her to be his queen. And he was idly asking her one night, oh, my queen, who do you love most in this world? You know, expecting, oh, well, you, my dear lord. And she said, myself. He got extremely bent out of shape and went to the Buddha and said, who did I hook up with here, you know, the ungrateful wretch? I raise her up from, you know, being a cowherd, you know, flower girl to the queen of the country, and now she's talking about, and then the Buddha said, oh no, everyone to themselves is dear. So he was saying that if you're going to open your heart and you're going to be loving, you should love yourself no less and no more than another. And so that's what she was really saying. Okay. Who do you love most in the world? And he was saying, oh, and hoping she'd say, oh, I put you above me, dear Lord, you know. And she's saying, oh. And then he kind of repeated her view, you know. I travel the four quarters of the earth in my mind, nor did I find any more deserving of love than myself. So that's the state of mind from which it can be very skillful to look back on past words and deeds and their consequences. Because you're looking back, opening your heart to who you were at that point in time. Realizing that it was somebody similar to who you are now, but not the same. And when we can be in that place of self-compassion, okay, the good thing about that is that it makes it less likely that we're again going to do something unskillful like what we did before. That's the real value of remorse, is being able to learn from our mistakes. So when you remember the unskillful, the two ways you can do it is you can fall into the slew of self-condemnation, you know, of guilt and shame. The other, the memory is just as clear, but you're not taking it quite so personally because you're realizing that who it was that did that thing is somebody who, it is to be hoped, was in a somewhat less enlightened state than you are now. Had I known then what I know now in terms of the harm that my action was going to cause, I surely would not have done it. The wisdom factors and insight meditation, that's a great deal of what they're about. It's being able to kind of sit to one side and look with some degree of compassion, like down through a tunnel in time, looking at all the causes and conditions that gave rise to who we are in that moment, all the things that we ever did, the skillful and the unskillful, the wholesome and the unwholesome, that gave rise to who we are at this moment in time. When you can look back into your own history with that power of insight, then it becomes very clear in some ways why you are as you are at this moment in time. And when you have that kind of insight, what it does is to make it oh so much less likely that you're going to do anything equally unskillful in the future. Because you were able to see the harm, like the rock dropped in the pond, right? The ripples going out. You can see the ripples of your own karma from a past word or a past deed and how it influenced others, on how it influenced you, how it's causing you to look at yourself in this point in time. And then, thusly, who may I be in the future? Hopefully somebody a little wiser. little kinder, a little more insightful, a little more understanding of what happens when you speak out of anger, or when you speak out of greed or desire, okay, or out of delusion, or out of fear. Okay. Yes, please.
Would you guys mind turning it up just a tiny bit?
Oh, okay, the volume?
Thank you.
Yeah, of course. Thanks.
Thanks.
Please.
Dangerous as this may be, I'm going to think out loud.
It's okay. Just try to stay one teeny step ahead of yourself.
This transition from guilt and shame to remorse, I think, is a big part of the reason that I struggled so much with Christianity as a child and a young person. As I think about it, I think Christianity, as we know it, and the Baptist faith as I knew it, is trying to offer the same thing, but in some ways that weren't very constructive for me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm starting out with a belief that we are all depraved and full of guilt and shame, or should be, in the moment of born. And that we can find that transition externally. This didn't seem to work as well.
I was raised in the same tradition, actually. And Sharon Salzberg talks about, most of the, certainly most of the people of European or African or Asian, not Asian, lineage who come to Buddha Dharma come to it from some other tradition, right? And a lot of them she describes as being what she calls spiritually wounded. And what she means by that is that they were raised in a tradition that cleaved the self, that kind of cut the self in half, right? And that half the self was inherently flawed, born into sin. Okay, so you start off with a big deficit.
Yeah.
you start off in a flawed or warped or unwhole or unclean, immoral state. And that the only way that you can make yourself whole, okay, is to throw yourself at the mercy of the Godhead, of the, depending on what the tradition is, of some external authority figure, whether it's Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, or, different traditions have different ways of understanding that, but there's some omniscient, omnipresent, external deity to whom you, the flawed, imperfect one, need to surrender yourself in the hopes of being made whole again. Okay. And that there is a bit of divine in you, but that you're also really a scumbag.
And not in that order.
No, exactly. And that your only hope is to beseech forgiveness from, acceptance by, some deity or other. And so a lot of, in this alternative view, a lot is got to do with trying to heal this inner cleavage, healing this sort of inner wound, coming to a different understanding of who we are, okay? And the different understanding is that within the mind, within the heart and mind, there's a vast array of what Ajahn Amaro calls potentially existent states of mind. There are the tendencies toward aversion, attachment, delusion, and whatnot, but there are equally powerful tendencies toward loving kindness and compassion and open-heartedness and wisdom and whatnot. they don't exist on separate sides of the football stadium. You know, that's all kind of in there together. Okay. And you know, one of the teachings the Dalai Lama frequently gives, but you hear it in other Buddha Dharma traditions as well, is put no one out of your heart. Right? And so rather than being kind of rent asunder internally, this understanding is that every aspect of who we are is to be accepted in an open-hearted and compassionate way, including those things that we tend to feel worst about, that we tend to feel the most ashamed of. Okay, there's a wonderful book that the entire teaching of which is about that. It's called Radical Acceptance by Tara Brach. Okay, and that's what she's, you know, saying. You know, loving yourself at the heart of the Buddha. So it starts from a different place. Okay, the 19th century British bureaucrat translators that founded the Polytechnic Society and the missionaries, you know, they used the word evil a lot, you know, because it was the closest approximation to what the King James Version of the Bible was talking about. More recently and more often you hear terms like skillful and unskillful, wholesome and unwholesome. So rather than being inherently evil and imbued with, you know, malevolent forces, what, right? That instead, it's the behaviors that caused harm, that caused pain, that caused suffering, we're done out of ignorance. We're done out of not knowing. We're done out of not realizing the true consequences of saying and doing what they did. Okay, and so the languaging's pretty important, because basically all it's saying is that we're all together on this learning curve, you know. We're learning from our own karma, we're learning from our own history, you know, just as we are from the behavior of others. And that the effects of that learning, it's not like, you know, we're all going to sit down and take some standardized test, right? It's like we're taking the test all the time, right? In terms of our speech and behavior in the moment, you know. Have we learned anything from our inquiry? Have we learned anything from our practice that allows us to live more skillfully and more compassionately in the moment? Okay. Please.
I think the good news for people like Bill, myself, others who have maybe come from a pretty stultifying Christian tradition is there's a whole body of literature out there now from people like Penny Tyndale and Dorothy Day and Rosemary Radford Ruther and Cynthia Bujold and Karen Armstrong even. She talks about these things. I mean, it's and Matthew Fox's original blessing, you know.
Gospel according to Thomas.
And the Gospel according to Mary Magdalene.
Yeah.
And on and on and on.
Sure.
I mean, there's just so much that we don't have to throw out the baby with the bathwater, which is why I'm here.
Yeah.
as a sort of progressive liberation theology Christian, wanting to find those common grounds.
Oh, yes.
And Merton talked about it.
Oh, of course. Yeah, some of Merton's.
So I think that's the good news.
Yeah, yeah.
Both from a Buddhist perspective and possibly a progressive Christian perspective.
Some of Merton's most fascinating writings right toward the end of his life, he was spending more and more time in Southeast Asia, and was just kind of fascinated by what he saw and the potential touch points between. Yeah, please.
So as I'm listening to the discussion, most specifically about how we want to attribute to ourselves some characteristic that we're not happy with. I'm thinking about how in the sociological world that there's something called the fundamental attribution error that we are all not prone to, that we all do, and that is when there is something wrong, we attribute a characteristic to the other person.
Mm-hmm.
Yet when we look at how we behave, we tend to judge it as, well, it's because of an event. It's because I am being pushed in this particular direction because of the press of time, of whatever it happens to be. And as I'm thinking about this with regards to my practice, I'm realizing that when I am caught in that loop of, oh, it's my fault, I'm bad, I haven't done things right, I'm really attributing a characteristic to myself rather than looking at the action.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that the action is where I suspect that the remorse ties to action more easily. That is, oh, that was really unskillful.
Yep.
Now let's apply ourselves, let me apply myself to an action that is not so skillful.
When looking back on something we said or did that was unskillful, you know, either a little bit or profoundly, okay, one of the things that is really helpful is to not just reflect on what was going on in my mind, but also to look at the context, mm-hmm, which is to say, what was going on around me that caused me to feel threatened, that caused me to feel like I needed to strike out, or that caused me to feel like I had to lie, or something of that nature. Okay, so...
yeah, I think of it as a field theory.
Yeah, yeah.
You're in this.
So context is every bit as important as what it is you did or didn't say or do, because with that understanding, you can also see that when I find myself in a similar context in the future, perhaps I'll have choices that I did not have before because I'm more mindful of the cause-effect relationship between the two. I'm more mindful of my own past karma and how to avoid creating it again in the future. Thank you for your attention. We've come to the end of our time together. If you'd be so kind as to once again take your sitting posture for just one moment. May we live with ease, mindful of all of our past actions, both wholesome and unwholesome, skillful and unskillful. Appreciative of the skillful, forgiving of the unskillful. May we rest in silence and stillness and inner peace. May we discover our inner joy and be happy. May we rest in generosity and kindness of heart, one with all beings. May we awaken and be free. Previews of coming attractions. Next time we're going to talk about doubt.